The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Conley, and Judge Smith, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning. The next case on for oral argument is, I'm going to see if I can, Orcutt versus Cruz. Counsel, welcome to the Court of Appeals, or should I say, welcome to Zoom, and welcome to wherever you are this morning. For the record, as the parties are aware, I will just say that we are not conducting business live at the MJC today, but we're holding this hearing on the Zoom platform. We are maintaining an audio recording of the proceedings, and so, counsel, it's important for you to continue with our usual rules. Even though we can see your names today on the screen, we're only making an audio recording, not a video recording of the presentation. So do state your name as you commence each leg of the argument. If there's any glitch along the way, if you're having a hard time hearing or seeing any of the judges or opposing counsel, please just bring it to our attention right away and we can pause the proceedings. We all are getting used to the customary glitches and experiences of little interruptions in our Zoom presentation. At some point in the proceeding today, we hope to hear from Judge Smith's dog, who occasionally has something to say about the argument. But if everything goes smoothly, we will be on course to finish as we usually do, but otherwise we'll accommodate any difficulties as they come. Counsel for appellant, whenever you are ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Ken Schuler. I'm an attorney in Rochester, and I represent the appellants in this case. The issue before the court is whether it should essentially vacate a judgment that was entered in Olmsted County. We have two fundamental arguments in the case. One is that the judgment was not based on sufficient evidence. And secondly, it should be vacated applying the Finden factors. The standard of review for this case is abuse of discretion. One additional consideration when it comes to whether there is sufficiency of the evidence is, and we cite this in our brief, default judgments are vacated if not supported by sufficient evidence. So that's an additional consideration. I'm relying on the Whitehoff case for that assertion. Fundamentally, with respect to the sufficiency of the evidence, the problem we have here is that there was not evidence presented with at least basic foundation regarding the future medical requirements that the plaintiff is asserting.
You know, Mr. Schuler, before we get to that, yes. I was wondering if we could revisit the Finden factors. The good news is you had three of them in your favor. The bad news is the court found there was not a reasonable excuse in the merits. And it is abuse of discretion, and it's sort of, the language is sort of, well, you know, it's not just three out of four, it's kind of, you look at them and all of this, and, you know, it's kind of a amorphous, but what I'd like to know is, what is your best argument that the district court erred when it made its finding that your clients did not have a reasonable excuse on the merits? What's your best argument that that's wrong?
Well, and we admit in our brief that we at least make, I believe, a weak showing regarding that fourth factor. The three factors, as you've already indicated, are agreed to. They're essentially stipulated to. At the district court level, and we cite this to our brief, there was a discussion about this issue with the district court judge. And the fundamental argument that was made is that my clients, I would say, were confused, they thought there was insurance in place, and it was not the case. And we have a fairly, at least definitely from a layperson's perspective, a complex layers of coverage here that the average person is not going to understand. And sort of Grinnell coming in and out of the case. And I think that led to the default.
What are we to make, though, as I'm sure Mr. Johnson will point out to us, you know, they got that letter, which, you know, seemed to be pretty clear to me that best do something. What are we to make of that?
when you say let's do something, I'm sorry.
Well, the letter said, the letter would indicate that, you know, Grinnell has got no role to play in this. And it seemed to be clear that your clients were supposed to do something, i.e. get their own attorney and, you know, answer. I mean, what are we to do with that? I mean,
well, first of all, I would say Grinnell made a mistake in doing that. I think they recognize that now. And that's, of course, why I've been retained.
Oh, I would say they really recognize it now.
Right. Yeah, I understand that. And, I, you know, I don't want to go outside of the record.
Well, then don't.
Right. And I can only say.
So, I mean, is the argument that, I mean, even the district court, you know, there's some indication that the district court at the hearing on the motion said certainly at the time of the default, unrepresented folks who thought they were insured. Now, you know, maybe they thought wrong, but, and of course, you know, an insured's got a duty to comply with or to cooperate with the insurer and, you know, forward the complaint, but, you know, whatever. And then in its order, it said Grinnell Mutual may also be partly responsible for the situation created by appellants and actions, as they had an opportunity to disclose the additional insurance policy information to their client and failed to do so. So is that enough for us to say, you know, at the end of the day, there's case law that says we're not supposed to take it out on the insured if the insurer screws up. And all the other factors clearly favor your client. And, you know, this is certainly one of the more unique cases I've seen on a motion to vacate a default judgment. Would we be within our rights to say that's an abuse of discretion and therefore under the unique circumstances of this case, we are reversing and remanding for a trial on the merits, which, you know, then there's all that language about how we're supposed to have trial on the merits. I mean, is that your best shot? Because I really don't want to get into I really would like to focus on this rather than the medicals, because I will say I have some concerns that you aren't going to like, because I think there's, speaking for myself and not the panel, there's some evidence that there's enough evidence to support the damages. So what's your best argument for us to reverse saying the district court abused its discretion in applying the Findon factors?
So at the hearing, counsel for my clients, Val Sims, said, quote, at the end of the day, two innocent people thought they had insurance. And I paraphrased it a little bit there, but that's what she said. And then we cite to the transcript portions in our appellate briefing. And then, as you properly indicated, the court addresses that issue and says, well, you know, even if you're unrepresented and you thought you had insurance, you still have an obligation to answer the complaint. And so, you know, I go back to what I said and what was said at the hearing, that you've got two people that thought there was coverage. There was confusion about that. There was a mistake made by the insurance carrier in not defending a reservation of rights. And the district court made the decision that it made.
The counsel, here's my concern about it. As I read the transcript of that, there was not an argument made under Findon, under excusable neglect, it doesn't appear to me. There were no affidavits by Ms., what are their names, Mr. Cruz and, I'm sorry.
Gosh,
thank you. I don't think there was any affidavits from them saying they were confused. It's confusing to me how they can be confused when they were informed there was not coverage and they better get a lawyer or they face default judgment. I mean, whether they should have, the insurance company should have defended under reservation of rights doesn't mean that they were confused when they're told there's no insurance, get a lawyer, you face default judgment. So, and I think counsel even might have said at the hearing, oh, I could go get affidavits from them if the court needs it. Well, that's a little late in the game, I think, when you're actually at the hearing to do that. So what evidence is there that they were in fact confused, that they were represented? It seems like the evidence is to the contrary.
Well, you know, and we freely admit that it is a weak showing on our part. We don't have affidavits from my two clients.
What is it? If they understood that they are not insured, what is the excusable neglect? if they understand that they're not insured. They've been informed they're not insured and there's no evidence of confusion. Is there any neglect, excusable neglect at that point?
Well, I think you have two lay people in a complex situation who really don't understand what they need to do to get things done. There may have been some other things going on here too, but I am restricting myself to the record.
Well, okay? I mean, you know, following up on Judge, I mean, they can read, right? I mean, they can read a letter. I mean, there's no evidence in the record that they can't read. And yeah, I agree, you know, insurance is confusing and, you know, I mean, but, you know, once again, Mr. Johnson's going to hammer you on the letter your clients got. And boy, I think I would have, well, I would have done something. And I mean, I guess the fact that they didn't show up at the default hearing, does that cut in favor of your clients or against them?
Well, it's possible they cut a deal on a Drake release, you know, but that's outside the record.
Well, thanks for sharing that.
Well, you know,
that dumb, huh?
Well, you know, somebody may have led them down the path, so to speak.
Well, why don't you, speaking of path, I think we've exhausted.
Yeah, speaking of path, we might want to get back on the record.
Okay.
Right. Would you focus on what you believe is bad about the damages, the proof of damages?
I do. You know, you have to have at least minimal foundation. As I indicated previously, you can't get up at the default hearing and just say, well, I think you're going to have this surgery in the future and you're going to have this number of surgeries. And my estimate for the value of that is $275,000. The law requires you to come in at least with some basic evidence, with basic foundation that establishes the damage claim that you're asserting. And, you know, I could go into detail on that. I'm kind of curious about the point that you've raised about,
maybe something in the record. This woman, you know, it's not like, you know, when you have a bad hip, it magically gets better with age. I mean, what is the standard of proof? Is it preponderance of the evidence?
It is.
Okay, well, you know, I mean, I don't think there's any, in my opinion, it's clear this woman is going to incur future medicals. I mean, I just think it is. Why am I wrong? Or is it the amount of the future medicals?
Well, it's the amount. And it's easy to surmise that there'll be some level of future pain and suffering and some level of medical expense. But it can't be based on, you can't get in a damage award based on speculation about that. There has to be someone with minimal foundation. And, we cite you to the Renswick case, which, by the way, I was the defense lawyer on the Renswick case. And we went round and round on that. And you've got to come in with something basic.
But you at least provided an answer, right?
An answer. Oh, yeah. No, we went through a trial and everything.
Oh,
so.
Wow.
So, yeah, we did answer the complaint in Renswick. You got to have get a letter from a doctor. I've seen that used before. Just something basic. The lawyer getting up and saying something really is that scenario that appellate courts have talked about, where you give the district court a blank check and the district court doesn't probe at all in this case regarding the sufficiency of the evidence.
Counsel, why don't you give any, why don't you mention the letter from the doctor? I mean, there was a letter, was there not, from her treating physician? And I understand that there's, you know, it seems stronger, I thought, on the hip, maybe less strong on the shoulder. The knee seems like pretty problematic, but I don't know. I mean, I understand. It's not that it was just the lawyer, right? Or even just the allegations.
But it's the extrapolation from that where, you know, it goes too far. And there should be at least some basic evidence regarding those future damage claims. And not an attorney extrapolation.
Can I ask a remedy question? So sure. Just to understand this, are you seeking to vacate the default judgment to have a trial on everything, liability and all damages? Are you seeking to just eliminate from the judgment the future and the emotional, future medical and emotional, and the other, I think you complained about both, right? And the types of future damages. Are you asking Yeah, what are you asking for exactly relative to the default?
Yeah, we're asking to have the judgment vacated. We did brief that issue. The other side is saying that they recognize the possibility of a limited remand for consideration of additional evidence. We cite the court to the case law. We're not aware of any case that says you get a limited remand under these circumstances.
And so you're saying a full trial on all issues, including those that might have had. Okay.
Now, well, I mean,
liability and the past medicals and everything. That's what would happen.
Well, potentially that's what would happen. I think we've got a tough liability defense in the case. But what we're saying is vacate the judgment and we'll take it from there and let us have an evaluation of the case and determination of the case on the merits.
Okay. I was just wondering how that Hader decision fits in there, which is a case where we like reduced, it seems like, the damages and left in place a default judgment, but reduce some that were not supported, as opposed to Whitehoff, which seems to talk about reversing reversing the denial to vacate the default judgment.
Yeah, and you know the damages are so intertwined in a case like this that I don't know that it doesn't seem appropriate to me that you would be able to pick and choose on the damages. Then if the plaintiff has not established key material damage claims in the hearing for default judgment, then the appropriate remedy is to vacate the entire judgment. That's the fairest way to handle it, I believe.
Well, thank you, Mr. Schuler. You will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Counsel for respondent. You are speaking. We see your lips, but we don't hear anything. You are muted.
There you go. Okay. It's my first time at this. Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. My name is Greg Johnson, and I represent Respondent Cheryl Orcott in this matter. I'd like to start, I guess, with the Findon analysis. And the appellant's desire to eliminate the entire default judgment based on an allegation of a excusable neglect based on the insurance company Grinnell Mutual not providing coverage to them. And I think Judge Smith first initially hit it on the head at the outset, and that is that this theory that they're proposing now was not actually a theory that was presented at the district court level. That's number one. You will not find, excusable neglect mentioned in any of their briefs below. And they've abandoned all of the arguments to vacate the judgment that were asserted below. That's number one. And secondly, as the court indicated, this is not a case where there's any evidence whatsoever. They haven't made a showing, which is their burden to prove, of a reasonable excuse under the Findon analysis, even if they had brought this, made this claim below. And they didn't appear, the appellants did not appear at the hearing, which was held, I think approximately 5 months after the default judgment was entered by the court. And during that 5 month period, the appellants also did not file any affidavits with the court. And I cited three cases that I believe are very much on point in our briefs. And the first is the Howard v. Frondell case. And the Black v. Reamer case, and then an unpublished case of the court more recently. And these cases all cite each other, but they stand for the proposition that when you're contending that there was excusable neglect by a third party on the part of a third party, you have to show two things: reliance, that you relied on them, and that secondly, you took some you made some efforts to answer the complaint. And there's simply no evidence on either two of those grounds in this case. It's counsel alleging in their brief that these folks were confused, which is entirely opposite to the information, you know, the evidence that is in the record, and that including the October 31, 2018 letter from the senior VP of Grinnell, their legal department, specifically advising them that A, they're not going to extend coverage. B, they had no duty, they're not going to defend them with regard to the litigation, the lawsuit. Three, that it's imperative, they use the word imperative, that they get their own counsel at their own cost. And four, if they didn't do so, there would be a default judgment, or there could be. So you have that, and that's the only evidence in the record. So I don't know how you can, you know, say here that these folks were confused, that they relied on Grinnell, or they did anything over the next 5 months. The complaint was served on October 23rd of 2018. Grinnell sent that letter on October 31, 2018. The default hearing doesn't occur until, I believe it was May of 2019. And during that period, they did apparently nothing. And so there's nothing upon which this court could say that the trial court abused its discretion in finding that there was no reason, they had no reasonable excuse. And so,
Johnson,
yes.
Could you point me to a case, and maybe you can't because it doesn't exist, but are there any cases where when three of the factors, three of the Findon factors are in favor of vacating and this one isn't, that we've said, you know what, and the decision was made not to vacate and we've affirmed that? Do you have any? I mean, I would be comfortable if we said that, I will just say flat out.
The Supreme Court in the Gomes v. Houghton case said that you have to make a showing, you have to establish all four factors. I think that was a 2016 decision that I cited in my materials. And so there used to be the Court of Appeal, at least at the Court of Appeals level, a balancing approach. But the Supreme Court said, you know, you have to meet all four. Now, what they're trying to do is say, we made a weak showing, but I would submit they made no showing. I mean, to make a showing, you have to have some evidence. And so there's no evidence. And secondarily, or primarily, I guess, they never even asserted this below. And so here we are, and they're trying to, you know, extinguish the entire judgment, which is you know, inconsistent with I think it's rule 8.04. If you don't answer a complaint, you are deemed to admit everything except damages. So in no circumstance would they be entitled to come in, you know, 6 months, 7 months after the, you know, that they didn't answer a complaint and say, let's try everything over again. So I think, you know, from the liability standpoint, they're the appellant's liability for damages to Ms. Orcutt is established by their failure to answer the complaint. They have no reasonable excuse on that. The amount of damages is then, you know, subject to review, obviously. And I think the evidence there is sufficient. They'd have to establish that, you know, clearly erroneous, that there was a strong conviction that a mistake was made. And they seem to be of the viewpoint that Minnesota law requires, if any element or any portion of a damage award is not sustained by the evidence, that the whole thing goes away. And that's not the law. And in fact, I cited the Hader a couple, two, three cases on that, including this court's decision in Hader v. Kari 2016 decision, where the court and a few others, where the court has gone through each element of damage. When you have a segregated award, as this one was, basically like a special verdict form, and you go, you know, damage by element. And so we set forth in our submissions, you know, what's transpired with regard to Ms. Orcott, including, I think it's, you know, seven surgeries and now hip surgery, you know, is in her future as well.
Well, Mr. Johnson, what's your best support for the proposition that we would remand with only a limited assessment of future damages?
Well, it would be, you know, we did this for a couple of reasons. One, there's only $750,000 of liability coverage that's potentially
available. No, I understand the rationale behind the argument. Oh, I'm trying to get a sense of what authority there would be for us to follow that approach.
Like the Hader case and those, there's been, you know, they've struck those elements of damage or reduced the award. That was kind of our approach as a practical matter to say, hey, if you want to go back, they can participate. Other jurisdictions do that. And so, you know, they didn't, you know, when at below, they didn't bring any, you know, motions for amended findings of fact on damages. They didn't seek remitter or, you know, do anything with regard to damages. They didn't even bring a motion for collateral source offsets. And so in light of the limited liability coverage, it really has no impact, or probably will have very limited impact on us. So I can say this, that in Minnesota, I don't have any authority for that. Outstate, there is.
So is your just to be clear on the remand, it wasn't that clear to me. Are you suggesting a remand for, and then I know this isn't the alternative, you know, and that you're saying you wouldn't object to, but a remand to put in more evidence on a default hearing, at a default hearing to support that? In other words, uncontested? Are you saying, no, vacate that portion of it, goes to trial? It wasn't really clear what you meant by that.
Well, we were just proposing a limited remand on the future medical aspect. Is that
right? A remand to what? Do what? Have a trial on it, or have a default hearing? Because you said an additional Rule 55 hearing.
Right.
With participation, if desired. Those are two different things, right? A default hearing and then a trial.
Or, you know, if they really wanted to, we could have a limited trial on the future medicals, to be honest with you. So that, you know, that was an
account. What does the authority that you cited in other jurisdictions indicate that we would do with that? Remand for a trial, or remand for a default hearing with a limited factual dispute being resolved?
I did not cite any of the outstate authority. Typically, you know, in other jurisdictions, what I found was that they actually, when a person is in default, they allow, in California being one, the defaulting person that wants to vacate, you bring a motion under their, like, Rule 60.02 to vacate the liability portion, but you also can bring what they refer to as a new trial motion on damages, or a new hearing motion on, you know, and then it has a participation of the defaulting defendant just on that, on the damage side of things.
So just so I'm clear, when you say that there are other jurisdictions where this sort of piecemeal approach occurs, these are jurisdictions you've found where they have different rules that apply and that would facilitate that approach.
Well, they've interpreted similar to our Rule 55 and their Rule 60 point with their Rule 60.02. I think there's sufficient evidence. There's clearly sufficient evidence in the record for the past medical expenses. That's down to the penny of through the date of the hearing, which was $187,000 and I think 1 cent. And the past pain and suffering and the future pain and suffering. The only item that they really attacked was the future medical. And, we would say, there's sufficient evidence. She's going to have, hip surgery. She's going to have complications, but just to, make it simple, to simplify it, we wanted to throw that out as well. So our request here would be that the court sustain or affirm the trial court, the district court's determination that they did not present a reasonable excuse under the Findon analysis and affirm that, and then also affirm the damages. But if they, again, if they wanted to have a new hearing or a trial on that, we'd be open to that as well. So, but under no circumstances could we think that these people that knew, that now allege that they thought there was insurance despite the letter that they received and didn't do anything about it for 7 months are entitled to go back and have a full blown trial on everything. So that's the relief that we would be requesting. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal, Mr. Schuller.
Thank you. There are 2 points I want to get into. One is counsel's raising what I would call a scope of review issue with respect to the sufficiency of the evidence argument and the assertion that the sufficiency of the evidence argument was not raised at the district court. And in anticipation of that argument, I wrote out actually what our response is. And it's true we didn't make a sufficiency of the evidence argument below, but on direct appeal from a default judgment, this court, quote, may consider whether the evidence supports the district court's findings of fact, unquote. And that's
I heard him not arguing that. I heard that the argument is the excusable neglect was not made below, because obviously you can't figure out what the award is until later, the sufficiency of the evidence to cite the award. So,
maybe I must have misinterpreted that.
Assuming that's the case, where would we look in the record to see that you presented the question of reasonable excuse to the district court sufficient for us to say that that's a matter for us to review?
It was raised at the hearing transcript on pages 16 and 17 at oral argument, and then also page 18, and then it was addressed by the court at index 57 at 9.
Okay, and if we were looking in the record to find the evidence about reasonable neglect presented by your party, your client, where would we look for that?
The assertions were made by counsel for the defendants.
And so there's an assertion not supported by evidence. Is that a fair way to describe it?
There are no affidavits submitted by my clients, I guess, is what I would say.
Right. How would you answer that yes or no question? Is there an argument, an assertion made without actual evidence? Is that accurate or not accurate? And of course, if you say it's not accurate, I'm going to ask you to cite for the evidence.
I don't want to answer your question, yes or no.
Well, I'm afraid that's kind of the way it works here. If you want to answer the answer, no. I think I'm going to chime in here. I think we got the answer. What if we felt, Mr. Schuller, on the future medicals, is it within our power to say, following up on Judge Smith's question, not great evidence. I mean, could we just reverse and say no future medicals? But, you know, the evidence was not presented sufficiently to support a judgment for future medicals by a preponderance of the evidence. Therefore, we are reversing and vacating that portion of the default decision. Is that an option?
I think it would be unprecedented in Minnesota. You know, it certainly is an option for you. We were not able to find a case where that was done. But
didn't they do it? Didn't we do it in Hader? Am I wrong about that? I thought we reaffirmed summary judgment. Or wait, summary judgment. Why did I write that down? I thought it was default, but might be a note problem. But reduce the amount in part because of insufficient evidence. Those are just my notes. Maybe I'm wrong on it.
Well, you know, in our brief, we rely on the Whitehoff decision. This is our reply brief. Elk River enters decision and the Hill decision, all of which just automatically reversed. If there was some...
Yeah, it's I'm struggling with the idea that if you have like, say you're 5% off, you don't find 5% of the judgment is supported by the evidence, that you get to try 100% of it, the past emotional distress and all the things that you don't brief. Like that seems kind of problematic.
Well, but they're not 5% off here. I mean, this is a massive portion of the award.
There's like big past emotional distress, for example, that I don't think. Well, isn't there 300,000 sort of past pain and suffering and emotional distress?
Right.
Did you challenge a basis for that?
That's not part of our argument on appeal.
That's a pretty big number that you'd have the plaintiff would risk losing on a retrial, right? Even though you haven't challenged it here. That seems kind of problematic.
Yeah, and I don't have authority to admit liability, but we'd have a very tough liability defense in the case. So I see I'm out of time, and I'll just say, we just ask for an opportunity to have this case determined on a fair basis. If you remand this, it will be resolved on a fair basis. You won't see us again, and we're hoping that allow a windfall. No, well, not for this reason.
Well, if you promise we won't see you again, maybe, you know, that might depend on what we're going to do. But, you know, I've heard that before and everyone seems to roll back on appeals. So anyway.
Okay. But anyway, thank you. We ask that you reverse the decision and allow the vacation of the judgment.
Well, thank you, Mr. Schuler and Mr. Johnson. We do appreciate your argument this morning and your briefing on the matter. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period and we take the matter under advisement.
Thank you.
With that, we wish you a good and safe day and the matter being under advisement, we are in recess until our next case.